Welcome, Laura. It's great to have you on the Poundcast today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am with the Crypto Council for Innovation at the moment. I'm their UK policy lead. I've been doing that since about September last year. Prior to that, I've been doing broader crypto assets and fintech consulting. And before that, I spent about 8 years at the FCA, joined doing kind of broader governance policy, and then moved over to the newly established innovation department within the FCA, and then ended up managing a few teams and then running the whole department. So that included all the FCA's fintech program. So everything from Sandbox, direct support, advice units, the Global Financial Innovation Hub, GFIN, and most relevantly now, the crypto asset policy team as well.
Thanks very much. And I'm very excited to have you on the Poundcast today, because we're going to talk about why we are where we are in terms of crypto asset regulation in the UK, and more specifically, stablecoin regulation in the UK at the moment. And there's a fair bit of historical context to this, which I know you're well acquainted. For the benefit of our Poundcast listeners who may not be expecting a discussion of wider crypto assets from us, given we usually are more focused on new forms of digital money, I think it's important to bear in mind that when we're talking about this topic, we're talking about while the Digital Pound Foundation specifically considers stablecoins and other new forms of digital money, obviously we have to look at these in the context of the wider crypto asset landscape when we're considering some of the wider policy and regulatory challenges and events at the moment and things like that. So I think just to get started, Laura, can you define crypto assets for us and explain, you know, maybe a little bit of context around what is captured as crypto asset and what is out of scope?
Yeah, absolutely. And I will caveat that I'm not a lawyer, so none of these are going to be legal definitions. This is quite colloquial. So I would describe crypto assets as something that is a cryptographically secured representation of a value or right, and that will be based on some form of distributed ledger technology. And typically, those crypto assets can be transferred, stored, or traded electronically. That's how I would kind of broadly describe it. Now, in terms of what is captured from a crypto asset perspective, interestingly, there's a duality to this, because from a traditional financial services perspective, actually not as much is captured within the regulatory perimeter at the moment as some people might think. So things that are going to be defined as a security already will have existing securities regulations applied to them. But what we haven't had yet is much expansion of the perimeter from Treasury to allow the FCA, or, you know, as relevant, the Bank of England, to fully regulate crypto assets as a new form of financial instrument, as a new form of regulated activity. The flip side to that is there is a piece around financial promotions, which I'm sure we'll go into, that specifically just governs the marketing of crypto assets. Now, all forms of crypto assets are captured within that. It's an incredibly broad piece of legislation, but it does sit slightly separately to the traditional Financial Services and Markets Act, which is where the regulator gets most of its powers from. So you've kind of got these two pieces at the moment operating on slightly different timelines. But at the moment, it's fair to say that full authorization and regulation from the FCA, by and large, doesn't apply yet to most crypto assets.
Okay, so I think if we go back in time, you know, there was the 2019 FCA consultation on the crypto asset regulatory perimeter, and it established some things around the treatment of tokenized financial instruments. So financial instruments that are in the current regulatory perimeter that have been tokenized, and things that sit outside of that perimeter that fell into a broader bucket of crypto assets. And I think it would be, you know, quite useful probably for listeners to understand whether the process of tokenization of something that is already regulated, such as, for example, a financial instrument, as per the MiFID definition, so a bond or, you know, an equity or another type of security, and perhaps this is a different discussion, e-money, for example, if the mere act of tokenization brings that within some of the considerations for crypto asset regulation, or do they sit outside entirely?
So that's a really interesting question, and that's certainly something that's been discussed very lively with industry and regulators. I think for me as a kind of observer to all this, it feels like regulators would prefer the tokenization of anything that might represent a digital asset to be in a new within new sets of regulation, even when I've seen compelling arguments from industry as to why to keep some of that stuff within a regime like e-money. I think some of that might be around the risk appetite of the regulator and how they are generally viewing this stuff. There's certainly more conversations happening in that grey area around where, because this is a spectrum, and so one end of the spectrum certainly looks a lot more like the financial instruments that the regulators have been managing for decades and presenting a risk profile from a market perspective and from a consumer perspective that the FCA has already gotten itself very comfortable with. So I think we're still seeing some of that play out, but it will be interesting as the FCA in particular starts to come out with more robust frameworks around crypto assets to look at what that interplay is. Because at the moment, we've had discussion papers, but we haven't seen any what I would call a real legal instrument attached to a consultation paper that actually talks about how this is going to work in practice. And I think until we see kind of rubber hit the road, then it's still a little bit all to play for.
Okay. So let's take a big step back. Tell us about, let's have a potted history of crypto asset regulation in the UK. When did crypto assets first come to the attention of the FCA? and it's not just about the FCA as well. I think, the FCA has to be given the mandate to actually take action. And so how have crypto assets been considered and treated over time by HMT, the Bank of England, kind of other authorities? And how have we arrived at the situation where we are now, basically, where, some years following that original consultation by the FCA on the crypto asset regulatory perimeter, we've still not actually seen any regulation in place.
Yeah. Well, I'll try to keep this as potted as possible because I think we could fill a whole hour with just this. So I guess thinking about where this started, I'm just trying to recall the timeline. So I moved across to what was then the Innovate team in the FCA in around 2017. So a regulatory sandbox had already been established, but the team were not looking at crypto assets per se. They were interacting with tokens where firms in the sandbox might be looking at them, but that was kind of the extent of it. One of the reasons I moved over to the team was to establish a what was then going to be a fintech policy team. Given I had policy experience in the FCA already. When I joined, this was the point at which there were some big price jumps in Bitcoin, and I think it was starting to capture the imagination of government. So the Treasury
So this is 2014, right? This is
2017. No, this is later than this. We're in about 2017. This is about 2017. Now, the Treasury Select Committee, which has the power to basically call the FCA in front of them and grill them about a variety of topics, they decided they wanted to do an inquiry on cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin. And that was probably the first real foray into this space for government. And it became, I think, clear at that point that this was something that we were going to continue to work on. And one of the things that came out of that was the tripartite crypto asset task force, which was the FCA, the Bank of England and Treasury, seemed like a very sensible place to start on an industry that was still very nascent, very immature. Lots of reflection on all sides that at that point, there wasn't any need for a full regulatory framework. We weren't in that space. It was still like, let's work out what we're doing, where the market's going to go. So, you know, we were active in that. The perimeter guidance that you referenced, I'm glad you liked that because that was my team. You know, because the FCA had its sandbox, we were speaking a lot with industry, and participants were saying to us, we just don't know how the perimeter interacts with tokens. We want more clarity. And, you know, I at the time didn't believe that clarity meant more rules. I genuinely believed that clarity meant guidance, and perimeter guidance for me has always been a really effective regulatory tool, and often one that, you know, people forget about, particularly if you don't know the full suite of tools and interventions that are at your disposal as a regulator. Because
can you explain, for the benefit of the, you know, our listeners who may not be acquainted as well, what perimeter guidance is and what, you know, the FCA did in the sense.
So essentially, as with any guidance, a guidance document provides industry, a firm, with a way of meeting the underlying requirements in the rules. You don't have to do what the guidance says, but basically, if you follow the guidance, you will, by and large, be compliant with the rules. So it is a good way of explaining the rationale behind a set of rules if they're complex or slightly different to other things, if industry needs that. So you can apply guidance across the piece, across any piece of regulation. Perimeter guidance is specifically about what is in and out of scope from a regulatory perspective, not because the perimeter isn't set by the FCA. The FCA's perimeter is set by Treasury. So this was a way of saying to industry, well, these are the tokens that we would consider to be already captured within the regulatory perimeter. These are the things that we would consider to be outside. These are the things we would contemplate as part of an exercise to make that judgment. So a guidance document doesn't change the existing rules, in this case, the existing perimeter. It just provides greater clarity. And at that point, I felt that would be a really effective intervention because it wasn't an incredibly heavy lift. We didn't have to change any rules or anything like that, but it just gave industry some clarity. And I think it was really well received at the time. So at that point in time, that kind of 2017 to 2019, there was quite a lot going on, a lot of thought going into it. We had a steady stream of inflow from industry via things like the sandbox. So we were in very good shape. I think the first left field thing to come along was Facebook and Libra. That really kind of stirred the pot, to be honest. It was an unexpected move, and regulators around the world panicked, to be quite honest, because suddenly, you know, they were being presented with something that could have, you know, huge systemic importance from the moment it was launched, if it was ever to be launched, from an organization that wasn't a traditional financial services organization. So there were lots of layers to this. And I was certainly involved in the, what they were called, regulatory colleges then. So the EU in particular was pulling together regulators from across the European region to meet with Facebook regularly, discuss what was happening. So that was a real impetus for many jurisdictions to really kick off their own regulatory work streams. You know, it's not the only reason, but it's certainly for me one of the reasons why stablecoins has crossed the line more quickly than others, because of those initial impetus pieces. So everything was kind of lined up nicely to, you know, start to get some of this proper regulatory implementation in place. I, you know, when people talk about the financial promotions regime now, and a growing concern that its implementation has been difficult, we were talking about FinProms back in 2018, again in the context of an immature and nascent industry that wouldn't be able to handle full kind of MiFID-like regulation. Again, back then, I stand by this, it made sense. It made sense to do a targeted intervention that would protect consumers from what was, at that point, some very shoddy marketing, and people not knowing any better. I think you know, COVID then plays a massive part in this. And that is
in the slowdown.
Yeah. Because you're, you know, by the end of 2019, things are really, you know, good pace. Like even the 2020, you know, I was in Singapore in February as Singapore was shutting down, and I was there for an FSB meeting that was talking about innovation, talking about crypto assets. So, you know, global regulators and global industry standard setters were talking about this at the right time. But then COVID kind of redirected everybody. So whilst it does look now that things have been incredibly slow, and they have been objectively, there are some reasons that are beyond the control of the FCA, beyond the control of government, that have caused this slowdown. And COVID was a big one of those. You know, I went on maternity leave at the end of 2020, but I spent that March to December basically having to manage my innovation department, but my day job was actually, you know, liaising with Treasury on things like bounce back loans, a whole other set of stuff that really had nothing to do with the other, you know. So moving anything forward was incredibly difficult, and I know firms were frustrated by that. We had firms going through the authorization process, and the MLR licensing process that, you know, it should have been taking months, and frankly, it was taking more like years. So it was a kind of a perfect storm in terms of some of the slowdown. Then I think the regulator started to come out of that, let's say late 2021, early 2022, and refocus a little bit. Now, Treasury was able to kind of realign itself a little bit faster. That's because of the type of organization it is. It's a lot leaner, it can move a lot faster, but the gap with the FCA had already kind of established itself, I think. So we're in this sort of strange place now where it feels like, why are we not further ahead? Like, why have we only had a discussion paper on stable coins? Like, why have we not got legislation already out there? And I say, I think the reason behind that is complex. It's very easy to just say the FCA has been too slow here and not done a good enough job. Now, I'm not saying that the FCA isn't partially to blame in this situation, but I think it's a more complicated picture if you kind of track back over time. So I'm gonna pause there with my attempt at a potted history.
Thanks, Laura. And I think, you know, you raised a really interesting point there, which is the fact that regulatory perimeter, the set of things that the FCA has competence and jurisdiction over, that it can make rules about, is not set by the FCA, it's set by Treasury. And so the things that were identified as being outside the regulatory perimeter in 2019 through that consultation process, and that, you know, they need to be brought within the regulatory perimeter for the FCA by HMT and by enabling legislation as well, in order for the FCA to then do something about it and to get on with the business of regulating it. And, you know, in that context, it's been discussed as well that, like, the FCA has actually done as much as it can with the limited tools that it has. Some might argue that it went a bit far with the crypto MLR registration process, which they think, you know, for a lot of firms appears to be more like a lightweight authorization, or not even a particularly lightweight authorization, but to have the equivalent, like, you know, documentation and disclosures and things like that made as an authorization process. So we've gotten up to probably sometime last year. And then what happened in terms of the, you know, Financial Services Markets Act and the, you know, bringing things into scope? And how are things progressing now that certain activities are being moved into the regulatory perimeter? Mm-hmm. What are we looking for? What's the timeline for all parties involved in this process? What are some of the key dependencies? And what's, in particular, you know, from the DPF's perspective, the outlook looking for stable coins?
Yeah. So you've already talked about the interplay between Treasury and the FCA in terms of regulatory perimeter. So the Financial Services and Markets Bill, now the Act, has extended the remit of the FCA to allow it to regulate stablecoins, which is a very good first step. There are some additional pieces of regulation that need to be brought in just to kind of finalise those powers. They will be done through secondary legislation and or statutory instruments, so likely to be finalised soon. Treasury, EST, the Chancellor have said multiple times that those final pieces of legislation will be done in or by the summer. So we'll take that as green, given it's looking like an election is going to be later in the year rather than earlier. So we will hope that those final pieces will be in place. That will allow then the FCA and indeed the Bank of England to, you know, fully issue consultation papers. As I mentioned earlier, we've already had a discussion paper. So the main difference between a discussion paper and a consultation paper is a discussion paper is earlier stage. It doesn't have to come with a legal instrument. So on a topic like this, which is for new firms, it's new activities, it's a complex area, it's a good way of starting to engage with industry around these are the kinds of things we're thinking about and getting that early stage feedback. So that's why I think the FCA and the bank have gone down this route. But now they do need to issue consultation papers. And I think we'll see them pretty soon after we get the final pieces of legal implementation. You know, in theory, the regulators have to wait for those to be in place. You can do it at risk if you as a regulator feel confident in what is in those statutory instruments. But if something happens at the very, you know, the very last kind of couple of days, something changes, you would legally be required to consult again, which is a massive undertaking, which is why you would normally, from a timeline perspective, see the instruments out there and quickly afterwards issue a consultation. You know, it's pretty clear to me that the FCA in particular is working on those as we speak. There have been a series of roundtables going on to garner really in-depth feedback. So I think it's clear that they are working on those documents as we speak. So let's say we do get something out in the summer and that's not going to be impacted by any parliamentary purdah, because obviously if we go into an election period, then FCA won't publish any big pieces of policy. To be clear, it's allowed. It's not that it's prohibited from doing so. The bank is, because it's part of the government. The FCA is an independent regulator, so it is allowed to issue policy. However, it wouldn't, because that could have political connotations. So generally, the period running up to election is very quiet externally for the regulators. So if the election is later in the year, then I think it's safe to say we should have seen a consultation paper come out already. That would, as is usually the case, be a 3-month consultation period. The FCA will then take those responses, work up a final policy statement and issue that. You know, let's say that's early next year, because that would allow maybe 6 months between the consultation paper and the policy statement. It then would need an implementation, a transitional phase as well. My guess would be that way, it would be somewhere between 6 and 12 months, depending on how firms lobby. It might be sort of tranched based on different kinds of firms. But I think all in, we should be looking at implemented stablecoin regulation by the end of next year, so the end of 2025. I think we will actually have something applicable for firms. Be my crystal ball.
And that's assuming that there's no snap.
Oh yeah, yeah. Then all bets are off.
That's assuming that yes, that H&T finalises its statutory instruments in good time, and that the consultations are out and the consultation process completes, and that, you know, everything progresses against that timeline, then we should have a regime in place by the end of next year. And without going into the detail, because I know we're both exhausted from this topic, you know, I think there were some significant challenges with some of the proposals in the discussion papers, for example, that much of the industry is hoping will be addressed when they see any draft rules in the consultation process as well. So do you think that is going to add time, or is that very much worked into your timeline?
I think that is worked into my timeline. I think it's really a really good move from the regulators that they are doing these roundtables now. They are sort of 5-hour sessions. They're asking firms for input ahead of time. So there is meaningful engagement going on meaningful opportunity for firms to say these are the areas we have an issue with, and particularly from the FCA's perspective, as a policy exercise, I think what they're doing is very sensible. They are taking this existing handbook, saying, right, well, this set of regulations would apply in this way, how does that work, and kind of going almost chapter by chapter, which is a sensible framework to do this within. Now it's just about drilling down into those details and finding areas that are not workable. We don't think the risk appetite's quite in the right place, because we do need to balance this and compare crypto asset firms and the risks they pose from a market integrity and a consumer perspective against other firms in the market. And, you know, there does need to be a comparator here. So we will see once the consultation paper is out there, you know, where the FCA has landed on some of this stuff. If there is significant pushback from industry, then yes, things might take a little bit longer. It also depends on what any potential new incoming government thinks about this as well, because whilst, you know, the legislative pieces will be in place for the FCA to do this, and the FCA is, as I said, an independent regulator. If the government takes a certain view, it can apply quite a lot of pressure, or it could cause things to delay if other priorities come up the list. So it's not a case of once the legislative pieces are in place, there's like nothing will stop this. It still requires, mm-hmm. you know, impetus and desire on kind of from all stakeholders to get this across the line.
And this is for phase yes. one, the crypto asset. So this is for stable coins. Looking at the other phases, what do they encompass? And at a very high level, what are the timelines and some of the key considerations for those? Yeah.
I mean, from a policy perspective, you would have to repeat the whole exercise. There will need to be new legislation laid for the FCA to be able to regulate these firms. If we go down a, which is what I've heard talked about before, is after stablecoins, we looked at broader backed crypto assets and then go into a broader unbacked crypto assets. If we go down that road, and then the FCA will have to do its internal thinking, its consultation papers, its policy statements. It is a long timeline. My understanding is that Treasury has been contemplating this broader regime. I can't imagine anything is going to be done prior to an election. That seems highly unlikely. And anything that comes out afterwards will require sign off from the government at that point. And I don't think I'm saying anything highly controversial to note that observers at the moment seem to be of the view that we'll be having a Labour government. That's slightly more likely than to retain the existing Conservative government. So that is a whole different set of political factors that we'll need to be contemplating. We've had a Conservative mm-hmm. government in post for 14 years now. An incoming Labour government at any point in time would always want to change up its priorities and change its agenda. You overlay that with a quite extreme economic environment at the moment. So there is a lot happening. So I guess that's a roundabout way of saying, if we have a change of government, I find it highly unlikely that they're going to come in and say our number one priority is crypto assets. Now, in some ways, that might be beneficial, because it allows the regulators the time and the space to think about how it wants to approach this. On the downside, if you need to create space in the legislative timetable and get it up the agenda, it might be tricky. I do think it presents a huge potential opportunity for industry, though, to start to re-engage with government, say, you know, explain this stuff to them. Why is it important? Where do we think the risks are? What is the right approach for this stuff? So you're almost kind of getting a clean slate a little bit, and that can go either way. So I'm deliberately not putting any timelines on it, because I really wouldn't like to guess. It's going to take time. I would say that if there is a big market event, you know, nothing, you know, sort of focuses minds like a big failure. So if a big crypto asset firm goes under, if there's a big issue, then we might suddenly see this pop up higher on the agenda again.
And what does all this mean from the point of view of firms, the UK's position in terms of crypto asset services, innovation in this space, and the UK's attractiveness as well. Because I think one of the things that we saw, one of those possibly intended, but probably unintended, classic unintended consequences of regulation under the crypto MLR registration regime, a firm that is established in the UK and is providing crypto asset services in the UK has to go through the crypto MLR registration process. But because provision of crypto services is not yet a regulated activity in the UK, it was fine for a firm to establish themselves outside the UK, bypass all those requirements and provide services on a cross-border basis into the UK, given again, they're unregulated at the moment. And so this is almost an incentive for firms to not establish themselves in the UK. So if we're going through a prolonged period, potentially, of more uncertainty for the phase two and phase three crypto assets, then what ultimately will this mean in the long run for the UK's attractiveness and competitiveness? And this must be something that you're considering with your Crypto Council for Innovation members and stakeholders and things like that.
Absolutely. And I think we're at a real crossroads now. The UK has always, not just in crypto assets, but in fintech generally, been regarded as a global leader from its engagement with industry, from the market it has onshore, from the way it regulates. It has been a jurisdiction to look to for other policymakers to aspire to be in, for firms and to want to, set up as a startup and stay in. I do think we're starting to lose that now as other jurisdictions around the world become more favourable when I say favourable, I mean that from many different angles, from a clarity, from a regulatory perspective, from a stability of market perspective. So, what does that mean for firms thinking about coming into the UK or contemplating whether they want to stay in the UK? I don't think we're seeing at the moment a massive kind of offshoring of firms to other jurisdictions. But if I'm being candid, I don't think that's because the UK is doing particularly well. I just think it's not doing as badly as some other jurisdictions, namely the US. Now we've got the certainty and the clarity we need in the UK.
That's not really
where. But it's not where you want to benchmark yourself, is it? That's the problem. Going, well, we're not quite as bad as what's going on over there. However, again, We're coming up to an election in the US. There have been several meaningful attempts to get bipartisan legislation through the Senate. So the US just has to nail some of this stuff and suddenly they will be streets ahead of the UK. And the US is always going to be an attractive market for crypto asset firms. So, we do need to think about that from a UK perspective. And, the government has been talking for a long time about the UK being a global hub for crypto assets. We've heard this statement pushed out, in big conferences, in speeches, year after year now. And, what has that meant in practice? Well, not an awful lot, to be honest. We've got stage one of stablecoin legislation, but that really isn't enough to create this global hub that the government has frequently been saying that it wants. So I think whilst we're not seeing that movement at the moment, we are at real risk of the UK becoming, frankly, a fast follower in a space that has always been a global leader. And that will be a huge shame because those advantages are easily lost, but very, very hard to gain back again.
I think, one of the points that a number of people have raised at some of those FCA roundtables and other discussions with regulators has been that around market access and crypto assets being a truly global asset class, both by, you know, design and intention and the nature of the market as well. And the importance of not designing regulation in a vacuum because of this global nature, the fact that, you know, some activities in order to be regulated require significant degrees of international cooperation. And obviously, you know, you've mentioned the US, which as a major jurisdiction, the absence of clarity around, you know, key tenets of, you know, crypto asset regulation and the applicability of their own regulatory perimeter is, you know, alarming and certainly a cause for practical concern on a day-to-day basis for many firms. But post Brexit in particular, is there also a question about, you know, which jurisdictions might be more favourable to establish oneself in due to that potential for greater market access? I mean, there's still, in the UK is a single jurisdiction, you know, pre-Brexit, you could establish yourself in the UK and have access to an EU market. Now that's no longer the case. Are we likely to see more firms establishing themselves in the EU so that they can be regulated there and still potentially, while there is this, you know, this lack of clarity, provide services on a cross-border basis into the UK? Do you think that that might be, you know, a model that we see growing in popularity over the coming years as MiCA takes effect?
Yeah, I absolutely think that these shifts do take time. It was never going to be the case that as soon as we left the EU, all firms would up and leave. But we are seeing those shifts happening. You know, hubs like Ireland, for example, are, you know, really attracting huge amounts of firms who want to go into the broader European region that can, you know, that can interact with a regulator and get a kind of hands-on experience. It knows what it's got to apply. And I'm not saying that MiCA is perfect, but at least firms know what they're dealing with. We're still seeing some of the level 2 and level 3 stuff playing out. So we're not, you know, completely final across everything, but it's so much further ahead. And if that clarity, you know, is maintained and the implementation remains consistent, then there is no reason. I mean, what then you have to say to yourself, what has the UK got to offer? It becomes far more of a competitiveness decision for firms to go to where it has that market. Now, the UK isn't going to suddenly lose its position in terms of it being a global market and its importance. I think firms will still want to have some level of presence, some level of access, but it will be a different relationship. It will be to the extent where firms might want to headquarter elsewhere and have regional offices or regional presence in the UK. Suddenly the UK becomes a satellite to another country, which is not a position that we are used to being in. So, you know, the government, the regulators do need to kind of capitalize on this and, you know, understand what is at risk of losing and what the stakes are in this, because, as I say, these things take time, but once that tanker is moving, it's very hard to turn it around. And I think there have been instances where the government and the regulators have been too slow to react to some of these seismic changes and too complacent in a regulation and approach that was from 10 years ago. We don't have to worry what we're going to do because firms aren't going to leave the UK. Well, they are and they will if this carries on and if other jurisdictions, you know, we talked about the EU, but in a market that is global, you've got jurisdictions like Japan, Hong Kong, Singapore that are streets ahead of this stuff. So there are so many markets that this can go into. And I worry, not just in the UK context, but some of these bigger regulators that are over here and in the US, that the question in their minds is still about, should we regulate this stuff? Do we think crypto really is going to be the future? Well, that question is at best from 5 years ago. The question now is, who is going to regulate it? Do you want it to be you or do you want it to be somebody else? And when you phrase the policy making process like that, suddenly the outcomes and the impetus really changes.
Yeah, and I think it's so important to also, you know, separate out what we're talking about when we talk about crypto, because people, and I think policymakers quite frequently, still hear the word crypto and they are thinking about unbacked, you know, native cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, and they're still thinking about, you know, NFTs and things like that. And I think, you know, there's this huge spectrum of different types of crypto assets. And many of them represent new and innovative ways to trade, to structure and to trade assets that have been around for some time. And so therefore, we're not only, you know, it's not as though we're necessarily losing out on only this niche crypto space as a jurisdiction, but potentially we're losing out on a lot of the, you know, the foundations of the future of the financial system.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, this is not a conversation about, you know, a teenager mining Bitcoin in his parents' basement. I mean, if the regulators have their way, there'll be certain types of stablecoin that'll be safer than commercial bank money. This is a huge spectrum of products that directly influences the future of how people in this country engage with money and engage with financial services. It's a massive conversation and one that, you know, we absolutely need to keep having like this.
Thanks, Laura. And finally, just as a, you know, to end on a positive point, after, you're clearly someone who's been in the space for a long time, and you're also clearly very passionate and excited about it as well. So what's most interesting for you as a practitioner, you know, with respect to crypto asset regulation, what appeals to you about it? What keeps you going? You know, even in what is often a frustrating environment.
Well, you know, you can take the girl out of the FCA, but you can't take the FCA out of the girl. So I am a policymaker at heart, and you know, the thing that I really get excited about and I really enjoy is the consumer aspect of a lot of this stuff. We spend so much of our professional lives talking to firms and individuals, and it's so much about the technology, so much about the back end and the kind of the philosophy of money, which is important. But I always try and pull the conversation back to, what does a consumer think? What does a consumer see and feel about this stuff? Because that for me is the most fascinating and seismic change here. Because, you know, as a policymaker, I can sit here and say, well, this is this kind of security and we're going to treat this like this. But actually, what is, if you tap somebody on the shoulder in the street and you say, well, what do you think Bitcoin is? You know, how do you deal with this stuff? Do you own it? What do you think? Is it an investment for you? Like, taking all the kind of implied meaning away from these words and actually understanding the space it could occupy for 99% of the people in this country. I think that's a really fascinating space that we don't lean into enough. I think the FCA does because it has a consumer mandate, but even it gets dragged into this kind of middle ground where we all want to debate the particulars, and that's important, but we always need to bring this back to, what is that front-end experience? Because that's where the risk sits as well. You know, that's where people can genuinely lose money, genuinely get hurt, but also where the genuine opportunity is and where, you know, financial inclusion and cost and access can all play out. So for me, that's the bit that really gets me excited.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Laura. That's been very interesting. For around the history, current state, and potential future of crypto asset regulation in the UK, and more specifically, the prognosis for stablecoins. So, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.